Arctic is way behind the times because it's just happening. So, of course, the industry is up there, you know, trying to get ahead of the curve for these safety regulations. And the big International Maritime Organization, which I, as I understand it, sort of the overlord of regulating shipping, has just starting to tackle these issues in the Arctic.
Hang on, Dan. That's all we have time for. Hold that thought. We've got the both of you back very, very soon to continue this conversation. But for now, my guests have been Daphne Wisham, the Director of Climate and Energy Program at the Center for Sustainability, and Dan Ritzman with the Sierra Club in Seattle. This has been Air Cascadia for Monday, July 27th, 2015. Kate Welch engineered the show today. Thanks, Kate. Kathleen Stevenson's at KBOOAM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts, know your rights, take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the summer concert in Dawson Park, featuring a live performance by Bamba y su Pilon de Azúcar Band on Wednesday, July 29th at 6:30 p.m. The mission of Summer Concerts in the Park is to bring cultural diversity to metropolitan area residents. Bamba y su Pilon de Azúcar Band play a full range of popular and traditional salsa, son cubano, timba, and tropical styles as cumbia, merengue, y bachata. Again, that's the summer concert in Dawson Park with Bamba y su Pilon de Azúcar Band on Wednesday, July 29th at 6:30 p.m. Dawson Park is located at North Stanton and North Williams Avenue in Portland. More information about ticket prices and directions can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Royal Dutch Shell, the world's second largest company, wants to find oil under the seabed off the coast of Alaska. After a disastrous attempt at Arctic drilling in 2012, the company has returned this summer to try again to drill exploratory wells. But just like before, they've hit a major snag. Shell's MSV Fenica icebreaker vessel, which was on its way to support Shell's drilling fleet 70 miles off the coast of Alaska, is now headed instead. In fact, it's now in Portland shipyard, and it's going to be repairing where it needs to have a 39-inch gash in its hull repaired. Saturday, the Fenica arrived in Portland greeted by demonstrations similar to those in Seattle last May when Shell's Arctic oil rig made a temporary home of the port there. This morning, we talk again with Eric DePlace, along with Nick Abraham, with the Sightline Institute in Seattle, about Shell's tenuous plans to return its drilling rig to Seattle this fall, while at the same time inciting equivalent hostility in Portland to the Fenica's presence here. Eric and Nick, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having fun, Barbara.
Actually, I think we're putting Nick on right now.
So okay.
We have a shortage of phone lines, so he'll be on momentarily.
Great.
Well, the last time we talked, Eric, and we planned to do this show, we were going to focus on what's happening in the Port of Seattle because we didn't know that Portland was going to become involved. So I wanted to start by talking about what this means in terms of what this new development means in terms of the struggle that's going on here in the Pacific Northwest to stop this area from becoming a major export hub for fossil fuels.
Yeah, and I think that's the right way to think about this question is, you know, this debate we're having about hosting portions of Shell's Arctic drilling fleet really fits into the larger context of a big regional debate we've had about whether we're going to become a large-scale coal exporter, whether we're going to become a large-scale oil exporter and depots for massive amounts of oil trains, whether we're going to move large-scale natural gas pipelines to the coast. And so, you know, there has been, over the last few years, this real upwelling of resistance and opposition and just, in a really positive way, a sense that this region is wanting to say no to a dirty old energy economy and say yes to something else. And so, you know, in that context, when Shell's drilling rig came to Seattle, I mean, it really incited people in a way that was, I think, quite remarkable. And, you know, now we're seeing sort of chapter two play out in Portland. And I really do think there's been an evolution and there's been a development in the way people think about both the immediacy of climate change and some sense of responsibility for the role that we play in either continuing down this dirty energy path or charting a new course.
I think that Nick is with us now. Nick Abraham, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
And Nick is going to be talking a little bit later about more of the Portland money connection that he's been researching. And I just want to mention that Eric and Nick wrote an article that's in last week's Sightline blog about the Fenica arriving in Portland. Actually, it hadn't arrived when they wrote the article. And what the influence that Shell's money has had in Oregon politics. We've already heard about the influence it has in Washington politics, but we're going to see that the net has widened. Well, I was thinking when I was reading about the Shell's initial disastrous attempt to drill in the Arctic in 2012, that didn't the vessel that went up to do the drilling that had such a horrible demise, wasn't it serviced in Seattle before it went up to Alaska back in 2012?
That's exactly right. It was serviced in Seattle. They have a whole fleet of ships that have to go with them when they go to the Arctic. It's so remote and it's so... even during the summer, it's still so dangerous up there that they have to have support vessels, they have to have icebreakers, they have to have ships to cap a well in case of a disaster, and all those ships were worked on in Seattle before they headed up.
So why was there so much more opposition this time around when the Polar, I'm trying to remember the name of that ship now, the Polar...
Polar Pioneer.
Polar Pioneer. When it was in the harbor last May... What's the difference now and in 2012? Why are people so much more incensed about Seattle being used as a port for support for the Shell Arctic drilling fleet now than they were a few years ago?
Well, people were fairly incensed when Shell was there originally, but I think people didn't get the word out initially when they were here last time. This was much better organized. Shell didn't want people to know that they were here last time. It came out through the Port of Seattle and through a few different articles, one that was broken by Sidney Brownstone at The Stranger. And people didn't know that that's what was happening when Shell came. It was something that people had to learn about, had to read about, and it was something that the Port and Shell both didn't want people to know about and took a lot of steps to prevent that.
So how did they find out this time around?
There was a couple public records requests and a few different reporters that did some great sleuthing, and they released it, and the rest is kind of history. It was like a war zone up there when Shell arrived.
And I think it's developing as a war zone here in Portland now at Swan Island, where the Fenica's birthed. But I found it interesting that news of the Fenica arriving here came out pretty quickly. I mean, it came out only a few days before the ship actually arrived, but it wasn't one of these suddenly, you know, reacting to something that's already happened. So it seems like the activities in May sort of set the stage. How would you say they set the stage for what happened in Portland over the weekend?
Yeah, well, you know, I should say when I first heard that they were going to send the icebreaker to Portland, I actually burst out laughing because I was like, you know, I couldn't help but think that you know, one of the reasons they wanted to avoid Seattle, apart from the fact that our shipyards are relatively full, is that it's such a hostile environment. So the idea of sending the ship to Portland instead just cracked me up for some reason, because obviously there's intense local resistance to this sort of activity. You know, there is a culture, a longstanding culture of opposition to dirty energy extraction. And, of course, it's home to Senator Merkley, who's just, you know, dropped a bill calling for a ban on Arctic drilling. So, you know, it's funny in a way that they're trying to avoid all the controversy in Seattle and instead, you know, arguably courting just as much, if not more, controversy by going to Portland. And I do think, you know, I think one thing that happened that was positive in Seattle didn't stop the drilling rig from leaving, but we did generate a lot of discussion about that at a national and international level. And, you know, there's good evidence to believe that the more people talk about this stuff, the less they like it. So I think that's really kind of, you know, the sort of baton that Portland picks up now is to continue generating public discussion about whether or not it's a wise idea to be drilling for these last reserves of oil up in the Arctic.
Well, what exactly is this icebreaker that's being repaired in at Swan Island now? And why is it so critical to Shell's ability to be able to drill for oil this summer in the Arctic?
Well, the Fennica is, like you said, it's an icebreaker ship, so it prevents large pieces of from ice from getting in the way of the drilling. So they have a whole barrier of ships that kind of protect these two drilling rigs that they have up there. But one of the major factors why this one specifically is so important is because it has a capping mechanism on the front of the ship. This is the only way they can seal an explosion like they saw in the Gulf.
In the Gulf of Mexico, you're talking about. You're talking about the Deepwater Horizon Gulf of Mexico explosion,
yeah.
Right?
And they actually, the federal government did give them permission to drill in the Arctic, but they had a lot of restrictions on it, one of which is that they can't drill below a certain depth because they don't have that capping mechanism on hand because it's on the Fennica.
So does that mean that until the Fennica is repaired and gets back up to Alaska, they can't drill in the Arctic, period?
They can drill. There's just a lot of limits on what they can do. And frankly, it is dangerous for them to be doing it in general, but it's much more dangerous for them to be doing it without that capping wall and without the Fennica up there.
Now, are there other icebreakers that are going up with the oil rig as well?
There's one other icebreaker that's currently up there, but, you know, that's one less ship that they have now to be able to prevent anything from being becoming a disaster.
Well, the person that I heard from Shell, their PR person, was saying that it wasn't going to set them back at all having to send the Fennica down to Portland, and it seemed like Portland is just a hop, skip, and a jump from the Kuchiki Sea anyway, so it'll be back up in no time, and they'll have enough time to do what they plan to do this summer. How likely do you think that projection is?
I think they will be able to still drill in the Arctic, but it's whether they are going to drill in the Arctic is a different question than whether they should be drilling up in the Arctic without that ship up there. I don't think it will set them back, but I think it's upping the danger factor up there significantly.
Now, you said that they can't drill below a certain depth without having the capping mechanism. So the capping mechanism's here in Portland on top of the Fennica. So does that limit how deeply they can drill before the Fennica returns?
Yes. That's exactly right.
So, right. My understanding is that they'll be drilling what they call top wells, which is they're going to go down, I can't remember exactly how many feet, but it's quite a ways, but it's supposed to be substantially above the layer where they would actually extract oil. So they'll drill those top wells, they'll excavate what's called a mud cellar, which is part of a contingency plan in case there were to be a rupture in that in those wells, and they'll do much of that preparatory work. I believe it is the case, and I could be mistaken, but I believe it's the case that their permits from the federal government do not allow them to begin extracting oil or getting down into that sort of hydrocarbon layer until after they have the Fennica back in place.
So how likely is it the Fennica will get back in time? I mean, they basically have, what, until mid-October to finish this before, and probably they should be done before then, actually, before the winter starts in the Arctic.
They probably should, yeah. You know, there's a 39-inch gash in the hull of the Fennica right now. That's a pretty significant hull breach, and it's something that they didn't notice when it first came through the Arctic. It brings in a lot of questions for people about whether Shell is responsible enough to be able to do work like this in such a remote and dangerous area. But a gash like that is going to take quite a significant amount of time to be able to repair. So it's kind of yet to be seen whether they'll be able to go back and start the real deep drilling.
So how did that gash get into the Fennec in the first place?
Well, there's actually a recent report that just came out through Fuel Fix. A watchdog group up in Alaska called Oceana looked at a lot of tracking data. All ships around the world can be watched and tracked to a fairly significant degree. They actually took a shortcut through a very narrow, shallow path, and when they came out of it, they had a 39-inch gash in their hull. So most people are assuming that they hit something while they're going through. It went unnoticed until they came back out the other side, and now they're back down in Portland because of a seemingly reckless choice.
So is this gash actually, was the ship taking on water, or is it just a superficial gash?
There was a leak, yeah, and that's how they noticed it.
That's great. And they had to travel all the way down to Portland with a ship leaking. That sounds a little disconcerting.
I would agree. Yeah, it's a little scary to know that they traveled that much water without a structurally sound ship.
Yeah, but and I do think it points to a pattern of behavior. I mean, it's not like this is the first time where they've had problems, right? I mean, we had in 2012 the Kulik, that drilling rig, ran aground. It had to be, it had to be destroyed. It had to be taken apart after that. It was so wrecked. You know, another one of their drilling rigs, the Noble Discoverer, which is up there now, was ridden with problems. And we're just seeing time and time again that not only have they been bad actors in the past, but they're continuing to provide ample evidence that they are just not the sort, they cannot be trusted to take this stuff seriously and to, you know, take any reasonable protection of the environment. So, you know, to me, that the Fennec returning to Portland after trying to make a shortcut like that, I mean, really, I think it points a finger directly at their just profound irresponsibility.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Eric DePlace and Nick Abraham, who are both with the Sightline Institute, and we're talking about Shell's efforts to use the harbors, the ports of Seattle and now Portland, to service their Arctic drilling fleets that are trying to get up, wells established in the Chukchi Sea or off the north coast of Alaska this summer so that they can explore and in their eyes, hopefully drill for oil soon. These wells would not be producing for what, another 8 or 10 years? Is that true?
I'm not sure of the timeline of when they would be producing. You know, they still have to find how much oil is down there. There's been a lot of estimates about how much there is. The U.S. Geological Service does a lot of those types of estimates, but that's all they are, is a guess about how much oil is down there. So that would have to be decided before they knew how much they're going to drill. They'd have to have the infrastructure put in place. I mean, we've been talking about this a few different times now, but this is an extremely remote area. The closest permanent Coast Guard facility is 1,000 miles away from where they're drilling. So if they're going to be able to get the rigs and the protections in place, it's going to be quite a while before they'll be able to drill.
And I was just thinking of this kind of ironic sideline, but I know after the Deepwater Horizon disaster, one of the concerns was that the plan for in case of a blowout that BP had, it was basically a template taken from the Arctic or from drilling off of Alaska, and they talked about walruses and other critters that don't live in the Gulf of Mexico. But it seems to me, in a way, that Shell is thinking about what they're doing up in the Chukchi Sea with a template coming from the Gulf of Mexico, that they're not really dealing with just how remote this place is, and that also the conditions in some ways are much, much more fragile than the Gulf of Mexico.
They absolutely are, and they're much farther away from any infrastructure to be able to take care of problems that occur. You know, in the Gulf, there's so much oil infrastructure down in Louisiana and Mississippi that they have a lot of Coast Guard facilities, they have a lot of protections there, and there still was that incredible disaster with the Deepwater Horizon. This could be, if they had something happen in the Arctic, it could be the same level of disaster with none of the protections.
And so what would be the scenario that you see if there was a blowout, let's say, on the size of the Deepwater Horizon blowout, especially if it happens before the Fennica gets back up to the Chukchi Sea?
Right. And that's part of why they put those protections in place, that they can't drill quite as deep. But like Eric said, it's still very deep into the water that they're going to be able to drill even while the Fennica's not there. The scenario would look terrifying, to be honest. Like we said, there's the closest Coast Guard facility is in Dutch Harbor, Alaska, which is 1,000 miles away. And even that isn't an incredibly well-equipped facility. This is a remote area. They wouldn't be able to contain anything if something on that scale happened. And frankly, they'd probably have to be rescued out of there like what happened with the Kulik in 2012.
Well, Eric, I want to get back to what we thought we were going to be talking about a few months ago when we planned the show, because my understanding was that there's an awful lot happening legally in Washington and in Seattle to the end of this month relating to whether Shell's going to be able to return the its oil rig to Seattle to be serviced after its adventure up in the Chukchi Sea this summer.
That's right. So most people don't realize that Shell actually plans to come back to Seattle, spend the winter here, and then sail north again next summer to sort of enter into phase two of the drilling. So one of the things that the community here in Seattle is working on is trying to figure out, well, how do we prevent them from coming back? How do we encumber them in ways that make it difficult for them to do business? And also, quite frankly, how do we continue to activate a national and international conversation about the wisdom of drilling in the Arctic? So, you know, basically right now, I think it's fair to say, without sort of revealing too much, that, you know, the environmental community has some very talented legal minds who are looking hard at the permitting authority that the port has, and the sort of land use permits that are in general required to have a vessel like that, moored there. I mean, there are any number of small caliber restrictions that Shell sort of ran afoul of. They were, for example, blocking a state Department of Natural Resources waterway passage, which you're not allowed to do on a permanent basis. They were in violation of a wastewater permit, you know, some other things like this. And on top of that, you know, I would point out that we have a couple of port commissioners up for election this fall. It's very likely that it's already happening. I mean, there will be a robust debate during this political season about our elected officials on the port and whether they in fact represent the citizens and taxpayers of Seattle, whom they, you know, claim to represent. So I think there's kind of a legal angle, there's a political angle, and then there's just the sort of the generalist kind of advocacy, raising public awareness around this issue. And I think, honestly, at the end of the day, probably all of that stuff goes south for Shell, in my opinion.
Well, actually, I was under the impression from our last conversation that there was a court decision that was going to actually be coming down in the next few days. I wondered, has that happened yet, or is it still pending?
It has not happened yet. We're still waiting on the results of that. But we should find out shortly.
And if that comes out in disfavor of Shell, what does that mean for Shell's ability to return to Seattle?
Well, it would mean that they would have, it would seem that they would have the legal ability to return here. There may be other hooks, there may be other options. It may be conceivable that the port could revoke the lease in some sense. It's not exactly clear what financial entanglements that would mean for the port. But I don't think that, you know, if the hearing examiner rules that that Shell is actually in compliance with existing land use and other permits, I don't think that's a slam dunk that then means that they sort of are allowed to be here and there's nothing we can do about it at all.
No, but let's say it's ruled that they are not allowed to return, that they are in violation of their permits.
Oh, if they're not allowed to return.
Yeah.
Well, I think things get really interesting. I mean, then, you know, they want to be in Seattle because they believe it's the best place for them to get the repairs and resupplies that they want. Now, what that means is then they'd be stuck with a choice about, are they going to find some other West Coast port? Are they going to try and stay in Alaska over the winter? They don't want to do that. Would they try to return to Portland, maybe? Would they send the whole fleet to Portland? That raises a whole other set of questions and probably raises their costs. Would they consider going down to the Bay Area? But it certainly makes their life a lot more difficult. Whether it would scuttle the enterprise altogether, I think, is an open question. So there are definitely folks in the advocacy community who with, you know, reasonable evidence, believe that it might scuttle Arctic drilling altogether. I'm not quite sure that's right, but it would certainly increase their costs, increase their delay, and make things a lot harder for them.
Well, actually, considering what they went through in 2012, it makes you realize that it seems like they are undaunted, no matter what happens, that they're so determined to get this oil. And it's a little disconcerting to think what extremes they would take to continue to get it.
Yeah, I mean, even we tend to, I mean, Shell is a giant company, right? I mean, they are absolutely enormous by any standard. But there's also a way of thinking about this enterprise as a measure of desperation in it. They are, and I think Nick can talk about this a little bit, but they need to get that oil if they're going to continue to maintain business as usual for that company, for their stock prices. So there is, for them, a strong financial incentive to get it at any cost, basically. And I think Nick has some more information.
Yeah,
about that.
Nick, what's the lowdown on this?
Yeah, so any major oil company is based on a wide array of factors of what their stock price is. But one of the major key factors for investors is how much proven reserves they have. Back in 2005, when they first started looking at going to the Arctic, They were one of the largest companies in the world. They were at that point the second largest. They're currently still the second largest, but they took a huge hit on their stock price because they lied about how much proven reserves they had. It finally came out how much where they actually were sitting at, and their stock price took a 10% hit overnight. Their CEO was fired, and they got a $150 million fine from U.S. and British exchanges. So they needed to find new reserves. That was the entire mission of the company after that. And Alaska holds 25% of the world's undiscovered petroleum. You know, like we said before, that undiscovered is a little bit vague, and it's a lot of times it doesn't come out the way that they think it will. But they cited that as the place, and they've been building up a massive fleet and buying up the water around the Chukchi Sea in preparation for drilling there and increasing those reserves, because it's the whole basis of what their company is worth.
Well, let's get back to the Portland-Seattle connection, because Eric mentioned that if the lawsuit goes in against the favor of Shell, and Shell is found that it's been violation of its permits, and Shell has to find another place for its fleet, and you mentioned maybe they come to Portland. I wonder if the Fenneca coming here is kind of like perhaps an exploratory effort to see what the waters would be like in Portland and how friendly they'd be for Shell to use Portland as its base.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, you know, it could be that one of the things they're trying to accomplish is to see how hostile Portland is relative to Seattle. My suspicion is that Portland is going to be at least as hostile as Seattle. I think they'll find themselves disappointed on that front if that is in fact what they're doing. But, you know, they really don't have a lot of good options, honestly. I mean, the scale of this enterprise is enormous. When you look at a rig like the Polar Pioneer, it's just staggering. And when you look at the amount of supplies they need, the amount of skilled workforce they need, just the amount of material they have to supply to these things, they kind of need to be in a classic kind of big city port environment. It's not the case that they can go do this stuff easily at some remote place like Dutch Harbor, for example. I mean, that was apparently on the drawing board at one point, but they really don't want to do that. But then, you know, when you kind of think about what the options are reasonably along the West Coast, I mean, it's hard to find a port where they could take this stuff in and not face tremendous amounts of public backlash. You know, in Seattle, you know, what happened is that rig moved in. People were incensed. A lot of people thought the storm was going to blow out quickly, but it just kept ratcheting up in intensity until we had the mayor coming out against it, the city council coming out against it, the county executive coming out against it, and it became a thing where sort of everyone had to get on side and you know, make a clear public stance saying, look, you know, Seattle is, we do not support Arctic drilling. We do not want Shell's vessels here. We do not want any part of this business. It's bad. My suspicion is that pretty much exactly the same thing plays out in Portland. God forbid they try to go to the Bay Area, but I suspect the same thing would happen there.
Now, one thought I have, though, there's definitely a divide that we're seeing up and down the Northwest and probably in the Bay Area as well between local governments and the ports. And the really great example is the Port of Vancouver versus the City of Vancouver in terms of wanting to build the Tesoro Savage oil terminal, which is a big port plan, and the city council's come out against it. And it seems like there's a similar divide in Seattle between the Port of Seattle and city council as far as having the Shell fleet there. Here in Portland, one of the big issues politically in the city is that our port is dying. Our last major container ship carrier pulled out of Portland, and we don't have the same kind of port that Seattle has. Not only that, it's not really a deep water port. It's not an a coastline port. You have to go 100 miles down the Columbia River to get to the port of Portland, and so it doesn't seem like it seems like on the one hand it's not a very good port for Shell to use for such a gigantic fleet. On the other hand, they're at least the port of Portland's desperate and might really want this. So I wonder how you balance all that out.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, Portland, right, has been sort of disadvantaged by the sort of changing trends in the way that maritime commerce works, for all the reasons you just mentioned. But and I can't really speak to the desperation question. It seems to me that the citizens, the populace of Portland, are probably on balance, drastically opposed to Arctic drilling by Shell or anybody else. I think you're absolutely right to point out that there has been this huge disconnect between port commissions and the public, and we've seen this play out over and over again in the Northwest. And I think that's a really fascinating dynamic to watch. I mean, port commissioner races are generally way down the ballot. Nobody really pays attention to them. And the port commission is just sort of this odd little government that kind of, cranks out some degree of industrial activity or maritime activity. And that's changing. People now are paying close attention to port races. I'm glad you mentioned the Port of Vancouver, Washington. That port, in some semi-secretive arrangements, they authorized what would be the largest oil-by-rail terminal, train-to-vessel terminal anywhere in North America, maybe anywhere in the world. And that was not met with great enthusiasm by the public there. In fact, the city council is unanimously opposed. It's become super hot politically, and we've seen versions of that play out over and over again in Seattle and other places too. And so my sense is that what's happening now, and again, the port, Vancouver, Washington is a great example of this. Port commissioner races will no longer be sort of ignored races down there with dog catcher and librarian. They're going to be politically contested hot races, and we're going to see a fight about who takes those seats and what those port commissioners do with the people's representation and quite frankly, with the taxpayers' money. And I suspect that it's going to go badly for the fossil fuel industry in many, many places around the Northwest. So I look forward to watching the results in Seattle and also in Vancouver and some other locations as well. Port of Grays Harbor out on the Washington coast, we're sort of seeing a similar dynamic there in Hoquiam and Aberdeen.
What's being proposed there that's of concern?
So the port there authorized sort of two oil-by-rail terminals in that little town with a third kind of in the pipeline. It's always kind of the same story, different context. There wasn't initially a lot of public input, a lot of public oversight. They authorized these two terminals. After some litigation, then they've had to go back and go through a full sort of environmental impact analysis process, so that's been slowed down quite a bit. But the public is opposed to it. The Aberdeen City Council come out unanimously opposed to putting oil terminals there on the grounds that it's very dangerous for the community to have those trains passing through, on the grounds that it jeopardizes the lifeblood of their economy, which is, fishing and recreation out there. The commercial crabbers in that area, they do not want huge amounts of oil traffic in and out of Grays Harbor, and for very good reason. Those races out there, I suspect, will also become sort of politically heated races. I think the idea that we're going to see public port commissioner races elevated and politicized will be one of the kind of the interesting dynamics of this big regional debate we're having over whether or not we're sort of part of the fossil fuel empire or whether we're doing something different in the Northwest.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Eric DePlace, who you just heard, who is policy director for the Sightline Institute in Seattle. And we also have with us Nick Abraham, who's a fellow at Sightline Institute. And together they wrote a very interesting article last week on the blog about the Fenneca coming to Portland, the icebreaker, the Fenneca coming to Portland, which is what we're talking about today in the larger context of all this pressure to turn the Northwest into a major hub for exporting fossil fuels. Well, speaking of political campaigns, Nick, you have done a lot of research on the money that goes into these campaigns, particularly coming from an entity called Royal Dutch Shell Company. So I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about what kind of money Shell is contributing to politics here in Oregon.
Yeah, Shell is a very big player in Oregon and Washington politics. They have donated over $500,000 since 2009 in Oregon. It's funny the difference to how they work in both states. In Washington, they structure almost all their money through lobbying, and in Oregon, they don't do any lobbying, and it's almost all to direct candidates. There's been, you know, a lot of it runs through their individual Shell stations, and other ones come from the home office in Houston. So it's very interesting to see how they structure that and who they go after.
Well, one of the things I found interesting in your article, you mentioned Greg Walden, who is one of our congresspeople here in the Oregon delegation, who represents Eastern and Southern Oregon. And there was a campaign contribution, or it was actually a reimbursement to himself or something for a political campaign that came from a Shell station that it appears that he might own. Is that right?
I have not looked into tax records if he does own that, but he is running a significant amount of money through that station. He has been doing it for several years, so unless he is really good friends with somebody that works at that Shell station, I'm fairly certain he owns it.
I mean, it's just kind of interesting to think of one of our congressional delegates actually owning a Shell station or owning a gas station to begin with. It seems like there's a bit of a conflict of interest there.
There absolutely is. I think there's no question about that. You know, it's not illegal to use your own money or your own company that you own to contribute to your own campaign, but it does bring up questions about ethics and whether he can reasonably be trusted to make the right decisions on fossil fuel issues in Oregon.
Well, Eric, you mentioned, one of you mentioned Jeff Merkley, who is one of our senators here in Oregon, who is trying to get a bill passed that would ban any further drilling or any drilling in the Arctic Ocean now. And it's the irony of Shell deciding to come to Portland to skirt the activism of Seattle when we have one of the most outspoken opponents of fossil fuel development and a proponent, a very strong proponent of really doing something seriously about climate change here as one of our senators. So I wonder how you see Jeff Merkley's role. And I'm trying to remember if he's... I didn't get to the demonstration Saturday at Swan Island, and I don't think he was going to be one of the speakers there, but I'm wondering if there's thoughts about him being one of the, you know, actually involved in the demonstrations that are going to be pursuing in the next couple of weeks while the FENEC is here in town.
Yeah, you know, I don't have any insight as to whether he'll be connected to those demonstrations, but I hope he is. I mean, thank God for Senator Merkley for what he's done. I mean, everyone has been having these sort of mealy-mouthed conversations about, well, you know, under what conditions should we drill in the Arctic, and what's the, you know, sort of existing permit authority, and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, look, I mean, his bill is clear and to the point. We should not do it. It's a bad idea. And I actually just love the fact that the bill is called the Stop Arctic Ocean Drilling Act of 2015, which, you know, I think that about covers it. So he's really laid down a marker that clearly articulates what I take to be the rational perspective on this, and the perspective that really represents Oregon and I hope the rest of the Northwest as well. And I'm hopeful. I mean, I could be wrong about this. I hope I'm not, because I'm going to say this on the air now. I don't think that either of the senators from Washington are sponsoring this bill. They're certainly not listed on the bill. That's really disappointing to me, and I would, you know, would like to see them, you know, stand up and say what is, I think, clearly the case. It's risky from an environmental perspective with respect to the ecosystems in the Arctic. It's not popular among the local constituencies, and it raises really raises the stakes on a disastrous climate policy that we've undertaken as a country. And so we need to just say no. I mean, clearly, and it doesn't have to be a big, long conversation, right? Just no, we're not going to drill in the Arctic. Done. And I think, you know, Merkley is such a fantastic spokesperson about that issue and so many others that, you know, I'm hopeful he does get connected to the demonstrations in some fashion.
Do you know if Ron Wyden's co-sponsoring the bill?
He's not listed on. I'm looking at it right now. Yeah. I don't see his name on here. But it could be that he's joined subsequently.
I hope so. I hope that the whole Northwest delegation joins. Well, in the last few moments we have here, I just was thinking, I was recently in touch with some old friends of mine in San Luis Obispo who I haven't talked to in a few months. And in the email, they both mentioned oil trains. And one of them is the mayor of San Luis Obispo. Mm-hmm. And I guess they're dealing a lot with oil trains there. But I'm just was thinking how everybody I talk to around the country now, everybody's talking about oil trains. And 2 years ago, before the great tragedy in Quebec, nobody was talking about oil trains except people like you, Eric, and you know, a handful of us. So I wonder if you think that the elevation of that conversation and the fact that oil trains are going through so many communities is also kind of ties in and has maybe a symbiotic relationship to stopping oil drilling in the Arctic and dealing with some of the other issues that we have around all the reasons why it's not a good thing for us to continue to expand our fossil fuel portfolio.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, you know, I can get a little bit heated about this subject, as many folks know, but, you know, what's happened over the last few years is we have had to confront the destructive nature of the oil industry in a very visceral way. We saw it with Deepwater Horizon. We saw those communities directly impacted, serious damage done around the Gulf, and an oil company that was basically committed to profits and lying. And I'm not saying that in a facetious way. I mean, I'm saying that in a factual way. And oil trains, I mean, this, the same thing we're saying over and over again. We have had 10 catastrophic derailments and explosions, 300-foot-tall fireballs from these trains that are rolling through our cities and our towns right now, including, you know, one of those derailments killed 47 people 2 years ago. And so finally, you know, we are having to recognize that this industry that is so enmeshed in our politics and so enmeshed in our culture is quite frankly, I mean, it's borderline sociopathic. I mean, they are at this point, at this late date, still continuing to fund denials of climate change, to oppose reasonable policies to address carbon emissions, to keep oil trains running through the middle of our towns. I mean, I'm glad you mentioned San Luis Obispo. The mayor there recently came out with a blistering opposition statement to prevent oil trains to that community. We're seeing pushback all around the Northwest, certainly, as well. And so, you know, to me, having to recognize how little that industry cares about our well-being, it does feed into the debate about the Arctic drilling that we're having in Seattle and Portland and other places, because I think they're finally having to reveal their true colors, and I remain hopeful that that when we can see clearly what this industry has in mind for us, we're going to chart a different course, and we are going to describe a pathway that transitions us away from oil and toward, you know, cleaner sources of energy that we have some control over and that don't blow us up.
Well, I actually wish I had in front of me. I don't know exactly what the plans are this week in Portland to continue to confront the Fennec. I'm wondering if Nick, if you have any idea of what's going to be happening and how people can get involved in protesting the Fennec's presence in Portland, joining the kayaktivist flotilla and other things that are happening, or where we can point people to get more information.
Yeah, absolutely. So 350 PDX is one of the biggest groups that's rallying people to go after the Fennec and really make their voices heard that this is not something we want in the Northwest. I wanted to also point out that Senator Merkley was actually at the first rally on July 19th, and he's been a really vocal voice about this on the national level and locally in Portland. But yeah, if I would direct people to 350 PDX and the Climate Action Coalition. They're all going after these guys. And
also Portland Rising Tide, I think. And you can just go to their Facebook page, and they're pretty much updating what's happening.
They can as well, yeah.
Yeah, and Sierra Club.
I was in Portland on Saturday, and there's quite a few people out there. It was interesting to see, for sure.
Yeah, I was looking at photographs of it. How many people do you think were out on the river?
It was smaller than the Seattle one, but they had a lot more time to prepare. So I was really impressed with the number out there. I would imagine it was in the hundreds.
And I heard actually, at the corner of my mind while I was setting up for the show, I think that on Chris Andre's show there was a mention that there's going to be an action tomorrow at Cathedral Park, and I'm not sure, I didn't get all the details. So you haven't heard about that one, have you?
I have heard about that one, and I'm that's where I heard it was as well.
Yeah. So for more information, I'm sure I would definitely go to 350.org, pdx350.org, or Portland Rising Tide, and you can get more information about what's happening. But there'll be a lot going on, I'm sure, as long as the Fennec is at Swan Island. So I want to thank you both for joining us today. It's been very good to talk. And I guess we should probably check back in maybe in September and find out what's happening with that lawsuit in Seattle and if Shell's actually going to get to return there or not.
Yeah, thanks for having us on, Barbara, and thanks for taking the time to dig into these issues. I think they're incredibly important right now.
Well, we're going to keep tuning into it, and I'm really glad that you guys are up there digging into the research and getting us all this information. So thanks for joining us.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Thanks, Barbara.
Sure. We've been talking this morning with Eric DePlace and Nick Abraham, who are both with the Sightline Institute in Seattle. You've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we'll talk with forest ecologist Dominic Della Sala about wildfire and the spotted owl. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by the Jefferson Airplane. Thanks for listening.
Good morning. It is 11 a.m. on KBOO Portland, and standing by in Studio 2 is Grace Eagle Reed with some guests. She hosts Disability Awareness, and that's a monthly show about issues affecting people with disabilities and their communities. You'll want to stay tuned at 11:30 on Voices from the Animals. Journalist David Grimm joins host Courtney Scott in studio, actually it's recorded, and reveals discoveries he made in writing his book, Citizen Canine, Our Evolving Relationship with Cats and Dogs. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support for a community radio station. Not a member? You can become one. Go to kboo.fm, click on Donate Today.
I'm a loving the old lion, a winner without fail.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of